Good afternoon. Welcome you all to our third case today and the final scheduled case of four oral arguments in March. We especially want to welcome Future Leaders Active in Government, FLAG. Would these people please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. And thank you for coming to hear our oral argument. Were they at the session? Good. As you know, and I've just found out from Justice Bradley, you were at our noon session in which there was a discussion between the students and Justice Bradley relating to the procedures that this court follows.
I didn't discuss that, Chief. It's okay.
Oh, do you want to discuss it now?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, whatever she discussed was very valuable to you all on the court. What she didn't discuss was the substantive issues of the case we heard, cases we heard this morning, or the case we are about to hear this afternoon. And we're delighted you all were able to join the other students. The other students, and maybe you too, were part of our Court with Class program, in which we invite students to come and join the court for an oral argument. This is so we can learn more about the court system, and we can hear your concerns and interests about the court system. And we've carried this program on for many years, and literally thousands of students have come to participate with us. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the deputy marshal will give you a summary. Okay, good. Thank you. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And you've already met the woman to my right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And to his right, Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left, Justice Patience Robensack. And to her left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our third case, 10AP2705, Kathleen De Bruin versus St. Patrick Congregation. Arguing on behalf of Kathleen De Bruin is Attorney Alan C. Olson. Counsel, you may proceed.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'm Alan Olson. My co-counsel is Jennifer Allen. This case asks whether a church that willingly enters into a one-year contract with a ministerial employee can avoid enforcement of the contract in a Wisconsin civil court. In 1871, the Supreme Court held in Watson v. Jones that a church is always free to bind itself in contract. In this case, St. Patrick exercised its freedom to enter a contract voluntarily. St. Patrick could have, but chose not to, enter an at-will employment relationship with Ms. De Bruin, having no contract whatsoever. In this case, the state did not foist upon St. Patrick any obligation or any contract. Common law in Wisconsin and common sense as well that even a religious employer that accepts the benefits of a contract also has responsibilities under that contract. St. Patrick's responsibility in its contract with Ms. De Bruin was to simply abide by the terms for termination. The easiest issue to dispose of, I believe, in this case was the trial court's ruling that the employment contract was illusory. The respondent argued below that the plaintiff was working pursuant to the written contract of employment in its motion to dismiss. The circuit court improperly held sua sponte that the contract was illusory and that DeBruin's employment was at will.
Well, I don't read the circuit court as holding that. In fact, I think in their last paragraph or two, they specifically indicate, it specifically indicates what it thinks a little bit about the contract. It then goes on to say, but that's not the basis of my ruling. And so I think it's not correct to say that was a holding of the court. Do you want to further elucidate your position or enlighten me or agree with me? Those are three of your choices among others.
At one point during the hearing on the motion to dismiss, it sounded as though the court were saying that it was a fallback position, and at another point that it was actually the holding of the court.
Well, take a look at the last paragraph. So I'm going to grant your motion to dismiss on this case on the grounds that of the doctrine expressed in Cooley and that the plaintiff has failed to show that the defendant has met the two standards so cited, referencing the two standards in Cooley.
Okay, and I'm referring to the transcript immediately above that at Appellate's Record 136, where the judge said that this is a contract at will, and therefore, even if the court were to make further inquiry, it would appear that there was a right for the parish. I don't think I get that far.
That's right. It says, therefore, even if the court were to make further inquiry, it would appear that there was the right of the parish anyways, but I don't think I get that far. My remarks here are just surplusage.
Okay. The reason that that finding by the court is important, Justice Bradley, is that the court has a responsibility to look at the contract and do all the basic things we know about to interpret it and to assign meaning to the contract. Giving meaning to each term in the contract, leaving no term unconscionable or unreasonable, construing ambiguous terms against the drafter, avoiding constructions which render portions of a contract meaningless, inexplicable, or mere surplusage, and adopting an interpretation favoring enforceability. And the court, in rendering its decision, did not engage in any of those steps in analyzing the contract.
Stopped after the first two-step analysis of Cooley as it saw it. Is that correct? Is that
yes,
your understanding?
Your Honor. Okay. And as the Court of Appeals said, it appears that a Wisconsin court would be permitted to look at the general neutral laws of Wisconsin, make a neutral inquiry, and make a decision in those kinds of cases. And but is obviously asking whether Cooley would allow for that. The contract in this particular case was a definite contract. It was a contract that was entered by the parties every year. It was modified certain years. They required Ms. DeBruin, the employee, to agree to its terms and conditions. In this case, the court said that it could only look at the first two levels of inquiry and could not even consider the contract. And as we know from paragraph 40 of this court's Cooley decision, as well as footnote 4 of the Hosanna-Tabor decision, it was found that the ministerial exception does not constitute a jurisdictional bar to a claim. In this case, DeBruin should have been permitted to develop the record through a neutral inquiry into the defendant's breach of contract. As stated in the Costello case, a plaintiff need only show that some form of inquiry is permissible and some form of remedy is available in order to survive a motion to dismiss. This case came up on appeal from the motion to dismiss. and should have been developed further and perhaps decided at some point on a motion for summary judgment. This case would involve direct inquiry into a contract claim. The Minker case is instructive, where in that case the court found that a minister's breach of contract claim could be adduced by a fairly direct inquiry into whether there was an offer, an acceptance, consideration, and breach of contract. Minker also found it significant that the remedy could be provided without court oversight. In the present case, the Bruins' termination resulted simply from her alleged failure to do employee background checks. And De Bruin performed the background checks. The claim is false. The respondent said that it became aware of this alleged failure as a result of a document review. In this case, good and sufficient cause, as identified in the employment contract attached to the complaint, was not based on religious doctrine. De Bruin was not fired for lack of scholarship, for example, or for violating a religious tenet.
Counselor, I didn't see where good and sufficient cause was defined any place in the contract. Is it defined someplace to include those kinds of things you're referencing?
They don't elaborate on it, and with this record, we have been prevented by the trial court from determining what that definition is.
Well, that's true, but it does say that she can't be terminated without good and sufficient cause, which shall be determined by the parish.
Right.
So if the parish gets to decide and there's no other definition in the contract, I'm a little bit at a loss to see where she's injured. The parish decided for what reason. Who knows? I understand it's not in the record because you didn't get to develop it. But if the parish decided it, and that was their contractual right to do so, how has the contract been breached?
The parish did decide. They made a determination. And that's all the contract says, is that the parish will make a determination. And that would always be the case. The employer would make a determination. The parish made a determination. That determination was false. It has clearly identified what the cause is in this case. And because that's false, as in any contract where there's a for-cause determination, the employee is permitted to challenge the employer's stated reason for the discharge.
Counselor, I may not have a full record, but I did read the complaint, and there isn't anything in the complaint that mentions why she was terminated factually. And my understanding from the briefing, and I could be wrong, but there isn't anything in the record that says why they terminated her. Is there something there that I've missed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Attachment to my response to the motion to dismiss, I believe it's Exhibit A, and I can give the appellate record number. That's attached to my affidavit. It's in the appendix to the Court of Appeals, and it is page number 29 of that record.
When you say the appendix to the Court of Appeals, okay, and it's your appendix, is that?
The plaintiff appellant's appendix in support of the brief.
It's our. Is that something that's in the trial court record, or does it just start there?
This was attached to the motion to dismiss.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Counsel, you're relying on your Court of Appeals brief and appendix here. Is that correct?
And a letter
and
brief.
And a supplemental
that I submitted.
Letter. So that the appendix that we have here that's entitled State of Wisconsin Court of Appeals District 2 would have that affidavit on page 27 and the attachment starting on page 29. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Olson, Let me ask you something that's giving me some concern. Should we be looking at this case in the light of the free exercise clause of the First Amendment, or should we be looking at it in the light of the establishment clause of the First Amendment, and also, of course, in regard to Article 1, Section 18 of the Wisconsin Constitution? Which approach are we to take here?
Your Honor, certainly it should be reviewed under the Wisconsin Constitution as well as the Free Exercise Clause, but I believe Cooley decision makes it clear that the Establishment Clause would not be the appropriate analysis in this type of case.
I'm wondering about that. As I read these briefs, there is a discussion of the entanglement provision, which I think comes from the Lemon case. It's one of the three factors in Lemon. And it's discussed as if it's relevant to a decision to be made by this court. The entanglement provision or factor, I understand to be one that comes up under the establishment provisions of the First Amendment and Article 1, Section 18. So are we really limited to free exercise in Cooley, or does Cooley really apply here?
Well, I think Cooley does apply to a limited extent in this case, but does not expand to the breach of contract type claim here. And the use of the term entanglement, I understand that entanglement is a term of art that's been developed in the case law with respect to the establishment clause and the Lemon test and comparing the countervailing interests of the parties. However, I think in this case the more accurate term to use would be interference, whether the inquiry by the court would interfere with that religious group, in this case a church, that made a decision on a purely sectarian basis.
Has there been any discovery in this case?
There's been no discovery whatsoever. Nothing beyond the bare pleadings.
Strictly based on the motion to dismiss decision made by the circuit court.
Do that, yes.
Counsel, I understand that the entanglement discussion, that is the establishment clause, at least in the Minker case and the, is it Petruska case, the Petruska case, talk about, again, both in the terms of a motion to dismiss and that on remand, I'll quote from the Minker case, that the trial court should be permitted, quote, to control the case so as to protect against any impermissible church and state entanglements. So I thought in the analytical framework that likely that's where it came in, based on the Minker case and the Petruska case. Am I wrong? Help me on that.
My reading of the cases is that some of these terms are used interchangeably, and what the real focus should be on here is the interference. Whether you call that entanglement or interference, I'm not sure, but it seems to me that the common thread in these cases is to look at interference and whether there can be a neutral inquiry. I think the rule that should be set down by this court should, like Minker and Petruska, take into account that the trial court could exercise control over discovery to limit inquiry into church doctrine in this type of case. I think there are other factors that could be laid down by this court to protect against interference with the operation of the church. It could look at whether the church entered into the contract voluntarily, whether there are non-ministerial duties at issue, as there are in this case, whether there's a neutral inquiry into the breach. Another factor could be whether inquiry into church doctrine is necessary to determine the existence of the contract or the breach. Another factor would be to look at the remedies, and this was found significant by Costello and other courts. The remedy in this breach of contract claim would not punish the church. The remedy does not require reinstatement of a ministerial employee. It's not a situation where the state would be foisting onto the church an unwanted ministerial employee. It would be simply a determination as to what money is owed under the contract and a straightforward breach of contract analysis.
Well, suppose the affidavit from the defendant as to why the employee was fired for cause was that employee made statements that were contrary to the principles of the faith. Would a motion to dismiss, should we grant that?
Not on a motion to dismiss, but perhaps pursuant to a motion on summary judgment.
Why not on a motion to dismiss?
Well, assuming that the pleadings are drafted properly and they set out the basis for a claim, that strikes me as a factual issue that would require the court to engage in a limited factual inquiry.
All right. So now we've passed the motion to dismiss. The complaint says it's a one-year contract. Dismiss the defendant can dismiss for cause. Your pleading just says she wasn't dismissed for good cause. So now we're at a summary judgment. We have affidavits, and now the affidavit says she was dismissed for not keeping faith with the faith. Did it get a summary judgment against you? Now we got to look at what the faith is and what she said and whether that's good cause.
Your Honor, therein lies the difficulty, and I think the inability to establish a bright line. I don't think the inquiry, though, is whether if it's a basis for faith that whether or not that was true or were to be true. I think the court's inquiry could be limited at that point to even question it. I think there's a distinction between an inquiry on a for-cause termination as to whether the employee did or did not do the act complained of, and the inquiry that goes deeper into church doctrine as to whether that act complained of constituted cause.
Okay. So the answer on summary judgment is never did it, wasn't in the city when it happened, alibi witness, whatever. All right. Then we go ahead, and the issue at trial is whether she said it or not.
We may go to trial. Again, getting there, it would be a church who didn't have the contract brought on themselves, but they drafted it themselves. They entered it voluntarily. They, in fact, required the employee to sign it and abide by all of its terms and conditions. It would be a case where there are non-ministerial duties involved. And a neutral inquiry into the breach where it can be looked at in civil law, secular terms on a neutral basis.
So even if this person falls under the minister's exception, if they have non-ministerial duties, you'll treat that differently than the minister duties. Is that your position?
I think it would be treated different, Your Honor, if it would require the court to delve into the doctrine of the church. I see I have a yellow light, an orange light rather, and if I were permitted a few minutes of rebuttal, I'd be grateful for that.
Well, you still have time on the yellow if you wish to say something
right
now in addition, and there may be some questions for you.
Thank you.
In response to our request that you brief the Hosanna case, You made reference to the Supreme Court's discussion regarding jurisdiction.
Right.
Why did you discuss that in your response letter to us? Of what import is that?
I think it's very important in the present case where the judge simply looked at the pleadings and said, I only need to ask two questions. I don't even need to look at the contract. And even if I did look at the contract, I don't think a contract exists. I think it's illusory. I think this is an at-will employee. So what the Cooley decision says, I believe, at least in one part of the sentence, as well as the Hosanna-Tabor decision in a footnote, is that this ministerial exception is not a jurisdictional bar. There will be some inquiry by the trial court into these other factors concerning a neutral inquiry in a general law of neutral application.
Specifically, it said it's not a jurisdictional bar, it's an affirmative defense.
Correct.
Why is that important, if at all?
It's an affirmative defense that presumably the plaintiff would have an opportunity to rebut and discover and determine exactly what that is and whether there's a factual basis for it.
Well, these are not easy cases dealing with the church. On the one hand, the Constitution and the founding of this state, of this country, was based on free exercise of religion and no establishment of the church, a church by the government. On the other hand, and those are very important concepts, on the other hand, the church, any church, acts within society as every other institution does, every employer, every owner of property. And so, on the one hand, we have to protect the free exercise of religion and no entanglement between church and state. On the other hand, there are neutral laws applicable to all of us. And they are applicable to churches, such as no bigamy, regardless of your belief, no use of peyote or illicit drugs, regardless of your belief. You can believe in them, but unless you got an exception in the statute, you can't use them. Otherwise, you're in violation of a law, criminal law. So the question in this case is, how do you make that balance between neutral, fair laws that are applicable to everybody to run a society, right, in which all of us have rights and responsibilities? And how do you make that balance against free exercise and no entanglement and no establishment? Now, breach of contract is just neutral and fair and applies to everyone. On the other hand, we've pushed you into questioning that sometimes a breach of contract can engage in a discussion of what the faith is, right, which is sort of off base most of the time. So we said in Cooley, and we said, the U.S. Supreme Court said, when it comes to anti-discrimination statutes, they're going to take second place to our concept of free exercise and no entanglement. Is it that easy with breach of contract? An all or nothing?
It is certainly easier with breach of contract, and it is it's a common law that preexisted the Constitution. It's pursuant to the Wisconsin Constitution, Article 14, Section 13. parts of common law as are now in force in this territory of Wisconsin, not inconsistent with this Constitution, shall be and continue part of the law of this state until altered or suspended by the legislature. This is certainly a neutral common law that is applicable to the parties who voluntarily avail themselves of that protection, and the church went out of its way to enter into a written document to do that.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Constonis, representing St. Patrick Congregation.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Attorney Nick Katsonis appearing on behalf of the defendant respondent, St. Patrick Congregation. At the outset, I just want to elaborate on one thing that was in the brief. The issue in this case involves the broad protections granted by the First Amendment of the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 18 of the State Constitution to a narrow class of potential claims. Okay. The issue phrased by the Court of Appeals in their certification request was overly broad for several reasons. Okay, first of all, we're only talking about employment contracts here. Okay, we're not talking about construction contracts. We're not talking about promissory notes. Second, we're talking about claims for relief that relate to the hiring and firing decisions of religious organizations with respect to ministerial employees, okay? In this case, the complaint had the contract attached to it. The contract was for a one-year term from July of 2009 to July of 2010. The complaint alleges that Mr. Bruhn was terminated on October 5th, 2009. The relief that she's seeking is money damages related to the inability to work from October to July, okay? Hypothetically, if the complaint contained a cause of action that said, for example, St. Patrick Congregation did not pay me for the work I performed from September 1st, 2009 up to the date of termination of October 5th, 2009, okay, that would be a type of breach of contract claim that would not be subject to the arguments we're making here today, because that relief sought is not related to the termination decision at all. Okay, that would be an example of an obligation that applies to employers in the world at large. And someone works for you, the contract says that she was entitled to be paid. She's entitled to be paid whatever the reasonable value would be for services performed prior to the termination. So we're not talking about that situation here. That would be an example of a neutral application of law that applies to a church. That would be a type of a breach of contract claim that's not subject to what we're talking about here today. The third reason that the Court of Appeals certification framing of the issue is too broad is because it ignores the specific contract language in this case. The specific contract language that was negotiated between the parties, that was given effect by the judge in the trial court, Judge Race, was not ignored, and it was negotiated by the parties because that's in the contract, is that the good cause determination was allocated solely to the parish. And the termination decision was allocated to the parish. So, under
but
these
narrowly in contract law where it's solely to one of the parties, there's a concept in the law of good faith, because otherwise it's a, losing the term, it's illusory. If I say, hey, you can fire me anytime you want, but we got a contract for 1 year and you can only fire me for good cause, to say anytime you want makes the contract, at least for good cause, illusory. So ordinarily in contract law, you read in good cause means a good faith interpretation and application.
You know, and if I was not a religious employer in this case, we would probably be here arguing about the standard of review and the level of deference given to the decision. Mm-hmm. Okay? But when the U.S. Supreme Court in the Hosanna-Tabor case looked at the framework, they said the First Amendment, because the EEOC in that case tried to say that, oh, you know, the church should be treated, the school, the religious school should be treated just like, you know, a voluntary organization. And they said, no, otherwise the First Amendment doesn't have any meaning. So in this case, the meaning that the First Amendment has, okay, is what makes it different with regard to the allocation of the good cause determination, because the free exercise clause of both constitutions prevents the court or the government from interfering with the decision of a religious organization to determine who's going to be one of their ministers.
Well, but that's the difference between the case relating to the age discrimination is, I think under that law, one of the reliefs is you've got to hire them, keep them. That's not true in breach of contract for employment. Usually it's viewed as you can't order someone to keep them in. You just give money damages. So I can understand saying, hey, you can't order the church to keep someone as a minister, or you can't order the church to hire someone as an minister just because of you can't discriminate on age. That's different than saying, if you fire in a breach of contract, all you do is pay damages. That doesn't interfere with the church's ability to hire and fire. Now, it does diminish the church's resources. I recognize that. But so does holding the church liable for sex offenses about which they know and which they did not act, and you get money damages, right?
I respectfully disagree with you.
Pardon me?
I respectfully disagree
Certainly.
With you.
That's why I asked the question.
The U.S. Supreme Court, in the Tabor case, the EEOC on appeal tried to abandon the relief of reinstatement and said all we want is money damages. And the court said that's just as prohibited, because an award of money damage is just as much a penalty against the church's choice of his ministers as reinstatement. And the failure to report sex offense example that you gave, that's not a hiring and firing decision. That hypothetical I don't think applies to the narrow class of cases that we're talking about here. Okay, and just on another point, you, at the end of your discussion, you referenced the Peyote case, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Supreme Court distinguished that case and actually said that the EEOC's position had no merit, because that case dealt with regulation of outward physical acts, and it had nothing to do with the selection of ministers or internal governance decisions of the church. Okay, so the regulation of outward physical acts would be more akin to the hypothetical that I talked about earlier, which is a church's decision to decide not to pay someone for work they've already performed. It's an outward physical act. That's not an internal church governance decision. That's not what we're talking about here today. And so I think that those are different situations than the issue that we're specifically presented with in this case.
Counsel, I want to target what is the issue presented. I have the sense in your brief and in your comments here about the contract that you're conflating the contract discussion with the constitutional discussion. And I think your constitutional discussion really is that this is precluded regardless of the contents of any contract, if it's hiring or firing. That's what I hear your argument to be. And so when you talk about in view of the contract, that just seems to me a sort of thing. But your real argument here is you narrowed the issue. So you're dealing with, let's say, firing. That's the facts here. That Cooley precludes this cause of action. There's a two-part test in Cooley. Is it a religious institution, and is there a ministerial exception here?
your opposing counsel has conceded both, and as the trial court judge said, ipso facto.
I think that's what this court said in the majority opinion in Cooley.
So aren't you conflating? Exactly who cares what the contract says with regard to your constitutional argument?
Well, I think it makes a difference in this case because it's another reason why St. Patrick congregation wins. I also think that the writing's on the wall, and if the contract was silent as to who gets to make the good cause determination, that the result would have to be the same.
That's right. If the contract didn't have that term in, your argument would be that you would file a motion to dismiss because the two-prong test of Cooley had been met.
That's right. And I think that the U.S. Supreme Court had the same analysis that the majority did here. Once they'd made the determination that there was a ministerial employee, the case was over with.
What case are you talking about?
The Tabor case.
The Hosanna case?
Yeah.
But that was a title. Wasn't that Title VII case?
Yeah.
That regulatory. Let me get back to the complaint here. We have a cause of action for breach of contract, but you haven't discussed the second cause of action for promissory estoppel. It seems to me in your hypothetical that a promissory estoppel claim can still be maintained.
No, because the damages that are sought, the relief that is sought, is related to the inability to work after the date of the termination.
What are the elements of promissory estoppel?
She relied on the fact that she had a contract to her detriment.
Well, you don't need a written contract, right? You need a promise, right? And you need a promise, and then you need a reliance on that promise to your detriment.
Mm-hmm. Right. But an award of money damages would still operate as a penalty, and that's not allowed. You cannot award money damages. You can't award reinstatement.
No, I'm not talking about reinstatement because she's not asking for
reinstatement. We're talking about money damages. The rationale, and I think I have the citation in the letter brief to the Hosanna Tabor case, where it's a penalty against the church for exercising its free exercise rights. It's made an internal decision as to who's going to lead its faith. Who's going to propagate its faith? Who's going to teach the members as to what they believe and what's proper? And in that area, they get to decide who that is. And if the government allows, if the court allows even depositions on that, the cost associated with that is a financial penalty. The cost associated, it could have a deterrent effect. It could operate as a penalty. The church might be feel like they don't have a lot of money to defend a case, so they're stuck with someone who's propagating their faith in a way that they don't want it done, but they can't afford the threat of a termination.
Does the First Amendment or does our Wisconsin Constitution preclude a church from entering into a contract with a ministerial employee regarding hiring and firing?
Does it preclude them from entering into a contract?
I mean, here,
no.
Part of the argument in the cases that were cited in the certification is, look, you have a right to contract. The church can voluntarily enter into a contract, and the Court of Appeals in its certification, when it cites both the Minker case and the Petraska case, keep on hitting that home, that contractual obligations are entirely voluntary. So is a contract regarding hiring and firing of no enforceable effect when you're dealing with a ministerial employee?
No, and that's not our position. We're not
okay,
saying
and that's
it.
What I hear you saying. Tell me why it's not your position.
Well,
they can hire and fire for any reason, you say,
yes,
regardless of what they might say in a contract on hiring and firing. Isn't that your position?
I think that what I'm talking about is the classic cases with hiring and firing decisions where the relief sought is related to that decision, okay? And so there could be other aspects of the contract that don't relate to that that would be enforceable. The rate of pay for work performed during the time that they're working there.
Counselor, would you agree that the St. Patrick's could have entered into a contract that said we will follow the common law rules applicable to contracts by non-religious employers and waive the right that you're asserting today they retained?
So the question is whether a church could contract away its First Amendment protections?
Well, like the state contracts away sovereign immunity. I mean, it's done all the time. They hired somebody from New Mexico
maybe.
To come to Wisconsin. Maybe they wouldn't come without such a provision.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, that's not our case.
I understand it's not our case, but your position seems to me to be rather absolute, and I'm trying to see if there are any places where it might not be so absolute.
Hypothetically, I could probably create a hypothetical. I mean, if the church decided to allocate the good cause determination solely to the employee, maybe that would yield a different result. I'm not going to concede that it would, but it might.
Could I ask,
okay.
Hypothetically, suppose this young lady next to me were living in Maine and answered some sort of an ad from St. Patrick's, and she came to you and said, I'd love to come to Wisconsin and St. Patrick's, but I'd like some assurance on job security. She's hired you. What advice would you give her in terms of how she could get some jobs? I mean, after all, she's leaving Maine to come to St. Patrick's.
Well, I would make sure that she's very comfortable with the people that she wants to work for. That would be the first thing. You'd have to meet the people and be very comfortable with your employer. You might ask for certain protections.
Such as?
Well, I'll be honest with you. The concept of contracting away your First Amendment rights, I haven't thought about that a lot prior today because that's not... You know, my job is to represent St. Patrick congregation with the contract that's at issue in this case. I don't know the answer to that, whether anything that you would agree to would necessarily be enforceable. I can understand the argument that it wouldn't be enforceable.
Counsel, freedom of contract, and that's what the Minker case and the Petruska case, freedom to contract away your constitutional rights, that's the way I actually read those cases.
I think the Minker, and I'm glad you mentioned that, I wanted to make this point, I think both of those cases were effectively overruled by the Hosanna-Tabor decision.
Okay.
And
before you get to that, though, that's not where my question was headed. You can answer that after you answer my question, if you will. And it's this, and it follows up on Justice Prosser's question. I have a friend who is the superintendent of Catholic instruction in the second largest school district in the country, Washington, D.C. And he is good. 3 kids, lovely house. And he got hired away by the largest, the New York City. And let's say, and I don't know this to be true, but since Cooley covered a teacher at St. Patrick's in Onalaska, let's say that his part of his job description as superintendent of the whole Catholic school system in the Archdiocese of New York is to be responsible for the formation of faith in Catholicism. So let's just say that. So, Tim's having a good job. He's got a house in Virginia, 3 kids, making decent income. But he's going to New York for a new challenge. That's his life. And he's then 47 years old. I mean, you mean he can go there without any security at all, no contract because it's the Catholic Church, and he would be considered arguably a ministerial employee if that's in his job description? I mean, he's given up his house, his kids are moving, he has a stable job there for the last 10 years in D.C. There's nothing to protect him from being fired?
I hope this answers your question. I'm just thinking a little bit about the hypothetical yes before. The Wisconsin Constitution, Article 1, Section 18, says that the right of free exercise of religion shall never be infringed. And this court said it's got the broadest possible meaning. So if push comes to shove, I would say, based on that language, it's the First Amendment. It trumps the right to contract that away.
And so even if they had a contract, it trumps it. You can't contract it away. Even if they had a contract that said, and for good cause is to be determined by the common law of New York, they can't do that. So Tim, if he brings a promissory estoppel claim for reliance on a promise to his detriment or a contract claim, he's just out of luck.
You know, if the Article 1, Section 18 applied and it's supposed to be given the meaning that the right to free exercise shall never be infringed, I'm not sure how that could be taken away from a church.
And it doesn't have to be for any really reason at all, as long as it's your position, as long as it's the church and it is someone who arguably could come within a broad definition of ministerial, right? I mean, there's no relief.
Well, we're assuming here that the person is already been determined to be a ministerial employee.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay,
that's
so
what I put in the job description.
By definition, that's a person who is responsible for the propagation of the faith. It's a person who's supposed to represent the beliefs of the church the way the church wants them to, and all of the things that go with that. That's inherent in the determination that you're a ministerial employee. And so the religious organization then has, I believe, the unfettered right to terminate that person without repercussions.
And without any cause related to religious doctrine whatsoever.
Oh, absolutely. And Cooley, the reason for termination had nothing to do with the performance of her religious duties. The school was downsizing. In Hosanna Tabor, the termination had nothing to do with the performance of her religious duties. And in fact, the court in Hosanna Tabor said that the plaintiff couldn't even inquire into whether or not the termination decision was pretextual, because that would violate the free exercise clause. That's why, I'm going to get my cases right. In Petruska, the appellate court thought that you could inquire into whether the breach was pretextual or not. And so that has been, I believe, overruled by Tabor. In the Minker case, they felt like an award of money damages was okay. Well, that was also expressly rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in Hosanna Tabor as being equally a penalty as reinstatement.
Let's not make Hosanna too robust.
Well, no, because at the beginning, that's why I limited it to
because
a narrow class of cases.
The court went out of its way to say, hey, we're only dealing with, let me use the term, regulatory. We're not dealing with breach of contract claims. That's for another day. And so they were, unlike some of these other cases we've been talking about that involved breach of contract claims, oftentimes in conjunction with a regulatory claim. But Hosanna Tabor specifically said, we are not opining today on breach of contract claims or tort. Correct? I mean,
right, because it was deciding the issue before it. It said, we're not going to take a position on that. If that case comes before us, we'll deal with it when we get there. And I think, you know, as lawyers, you take the rationale and underpinnings of the decision and you see if it applies to other causes of action. And the underpinnings and rationale for why the discrimination laws don't apply with equal force to the situation we're dealing with here today under the facts of this case.
Well, I went back and looked at the issues you ticked off as to why the statement, the certification, is too broad and why it should be narrowed. But then, as I've listened to the argument, it seems to me that your argument boils down to this. See if you agree with me. Where you have an employment contract between a church and a minister, the church has full and complete control of that employment contract, and no damages can be assessed for breach of that contract, because Hosanna Tabor said, quote, "The purpose of the exception is not to safeguard a church's decision to fire a minister only when it is made for a religious reason. The exception instead ensures that the authority to select and control who will minister the faithful, a matter strictly ecclesiastical, is the church's alone." So, if I understand your argument, if you got a minister and the church has an employment contract with that minister, the church can breach that contract because the church has absolute control of who its ministers should be. And there's no damages.
No, that's not. That's still too broad.
Okay.
Because
narrow me down.
Because you have to look at the relief that's sought in the complaint. And
when damages.
The relief, when the relief sought is related to the termination decision, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about the hypothetical.
Hiring or firing.
What?
Hiring or firing. Want me to narrow it?
Right.
Narrow. If there's an employment contract and there's an alleged breach on termination, the church's is the final decision, regardless of whether there's a religious or non-religious ground for the firing, and regardless of the terms of the contract.
I will take that position here. That's yeah. Broader than needs to be done in this case, but I think that, you know, on balance, just like the First Amendment trumped discrimination laws. The First Amendment that says that the right to free exercise shall never be infringed and the state can't interfere with it. That should trump.
Because the decision relates to who is the church's minister.
Yes.
And the church has absolute control over who its minister should be.
Yes.
That's what I hear you saying. So we can knock out good cause, we can knock out whether it was 1 year or more, it's employment contract of a minister. Church has who to hire and who to fire. And on what basis it's theirs.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's exactly what the majority said in the Cooley case. You can't interfere with hiring and firing decisions of a religious organization with a religious mission with respect to employees whose job is important and closely linked to the religious mission of the organization. That's just a restatement of the majority opinion in Cooley. And I believe that that's exactly what the unanimous United States Supreme Court said, although they did not adopt a test for determining when somebody's a ministerial employee.
Mm-hmm. I just found it interesting that they said, hey, we're not looking at breach of contract.
They didn't have to, so I think that's why they didn't do it. Mm-hmm. My light's on. I have a few things. Watson versus Jones was a property division case. Costello that was referenced, the way it was surprised is that some remedy needs to be available. As I explained, there isn't a remedy that's constitutionally available. The same thing with Minker. Justice Crooks had asked a question regarding Establishment Clause versus Free Exercise Clause. I think this is a free exercise case because we're talking about interference with the decision. The way that the U.S. Supreme Court summarized the distinction, I'm not sure that the Establishment Clause applies. It says the Establishment Clause prevents the government from appointing ministers. That's not specifically what we're dealing with under the facts of this case.
Could I ask you, sir, the church was doing criminal background checks?
There is nothing in the record on this. If you went to Google and typed in Archdiocese of Milwaukee on the public website, There's a program called Safeguarding God's Family. It was instituted 10 to 15 years ago in response to a crisis. And so every church is required, every organization in the archdiocese, to comply with this program. One of the elements of the program is that for every volunteer and employee, national and state background checks have to be done. A list has to be maintained at the church, and they have to pass the list. This is not in the record. Okay, what counsel referenced in the record, I explained in footnote 4 in my brief. I believe the evidence would show that, and I have the benefit of this. I mean, if you want me to tell you, I can tell you what the evidence would show, is that the
just
plaintiff...
Just tell us what is in the record, counsel.
Well, there's nothing in the record. And footnote 4 explains...
What about page 29, the affidavit and the... that's in the record. You mean...
I explained that in footnote 4 of my brief.
Yeah, I know. But it's in the record, is my point.
Well, but it's not evidence. It's just, it's a page from an unfiled brief.
It was your brief. I think you were going to, you were asking for sanctions for her bringing this case. You said in footnote 4.
I never filed the brief under the new statute. You have to serve a motion for sanctions before you filed it. I did that. I put two arguments in there. One was the legal argument that brings us here today. The other was why I didn't think that there was any factual basis for the claim. I provided some documentation to that. I talked to counsel about it. We agreed not to proceed that way. I filed the motion to dismiss based on the legal argument, and that's where that was lifted from. But as far as any type of evidence, it's just a page from an unfiled brief, and it's taken out of context, I believe. Are my red lights on unless there's any other questions?
You done? You are done. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Olson. Mr. Olson, I found it interesting that there was an affidavit and this was a motion to dismiss rather than a summary judgment. What's the significance of the affidavit?
As I recall, the affidavit was submitted to show the underlying purpose of the discharge.
Mm-hmm.
The motion was not converted to one for summary judgment. There's been some discussion about the remedies that are available, and in some of the cases, many of the cases, the courts seem to have reasoned that the employee had an opportunity to resolve matters through an internal process. So the question about whether a remedy is available to that individual was addressed on an equity basis or rationalized that that employee could go through that internal process. There's a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision from 1922. It doesn't raise the constitutional issue, but it talks about the remedies. It's Evangelical Lutheran St. Paul's Congregation versus Haas. And in that case, the court said that the right of a congregation to remove its pastor with or without cause is a temporal right unless otherwise clearly specified in the charter or bylaws of the congregation. Civil courts will apply civil remedies to the disputes of religious bodies unless the laws of such bodies provide for specific ecclesiastical remedies. In the instant case, we fail to find any ecclesiastical remedies in the Constitution. In the present case, there were no ecclesiastical remedies available, and this goes beyond what's actually in the record before the court. However, I think it's important that both in entering into the employment relationship with Ms. DeBruin, the church decided to enter into a written contract, and also after, there was also efforts, specific written efforts by the church to avail itself of the state courts and the protections that are afforded by the state courts in civil remedies under contract law. And So again, the main distinction here is between the Hosanna Tabor and the Cooley cases, where the court, or strike that, the state is requiring a religious entity to comply with a statute or regulation, in contrast to here, where the church is voluntarily entering into a contract.
Now, suppose this was an unwritten at-will contract, employment contract,
right?
Unwritten at-will. But in this state, we say in at-will contracts, if you terminate for cause contrary to the public policy of the state, as set forth in statutes and elsewhere, employer, you're liable. Right?
Correct.
If we take your argument, then any time there's an employment contract, then the church is subject to breach of contract under that doctrine, right?
Under those limited conditions that I mentioned, mm-hmm. They have to be a voluntary contract of not involving ministerial duties, neutral inquiry into the breach and the existence of the contract, remedies that are not punishing, remedies that don't foist a ministerial employee onto the employer. Circuit court, trial court would have the ability to protect against intrusion through the discovery process.
That would enable a court to decide what's a ministerial duty and what's not a ministerial duty. Right?
Yes. And if there are no further questions, I've completed my
answer. Ms. De Bruin worked for the church for, 6, 7, 8 years? How many?
Yes. 02 to 09.
And then suddenly, in the middle of a one-year contract, she was terminated.
Right. Shocking, no prior notice.
But, I mean, there is sort of a hint here anyway in the documents, whether it's in the record, the documents are here in front of us. There is some sort of a hint that the church had a reason to do that.
They state they have a reason, but it's completely erroneous.
Well, are you asking us, with all this constitutional First Amendment overlay, to just go in and figure out whether that's a good enough reason?
Not necessarily to inquire whether it's a good enough reason. That's the distinction between inquiry into whether the complained of act constitutes cause versus whether what they've identified as cause occurred in the first instance. We're in that latter category, requiring less inquiry into the church's operation.
If it turned out the for-cause involved ecclesiastical matters, would that end your case?
If it involved ecclesiastical matters, I believe that, based on the case law, would go beyond what Wisconsin courts have indicated would be an appropriate inquiry into the church's operation.
So the answer to my question is yes.
That's the short answer.
End the case. So you all want you want to be able to prove in trial court that there was no cause, or if there was cause, it had nothing to do with ecclesiastical matters, and there was no good cause.
Right.
Church said the ecclesiastical matters, regardless of your affidavit, that would end it, probably.
That would end the case if it required the court to interfere with ecclesiastical matters.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Olson, and thank you, Mr. Katsonis, for your arguments and brief on very interesting and very challenging questions as yet unanswered by the United States Supreme Court. But they've been working on this issue for many a year. That concludes our arguments in 10 AP 2705, Kathleen DeBruin versus St. Patrick Congregation. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:20. We are adjourned for our scheduled oral arguments for the month of March.